Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 12th September 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. Can I just say thank you to those of you who wished me a happy birthday recently? I have to say, though, September is, we might call it an official birth date. It's not my real one, but thank you for the sentiments.
Okay, well, we're going to get straight on here with the State of the Nation speech by Jean-Claude Juncker. I seem to have spelled his name wrong there. He's not really Jean-Claude. He's nothing to do with Santa at all. That is a typo, and that possibly qualifies as fake news because...
Well, it must be fake news that he's sober.
Yes, it could be. Could be. Certainly, certainly, if you actually listen to the contents of this, it didn't appear that he was sober. But anyway, he was saying that the European Union, is a world power, that the United States is... backing away from international engagements, and therefore the EU should step into its place. He said that when the EU is united, that it's a force to be reckoned with. He said, whenever Europe speaks as one, we can impose our position on others. So there you go. That demonstrates 100% what Jean-Claude Juncker is all about, imposition of his position and others. He was complaining about Brexit. He was complaining about Viktor Orban. But he said that the EU is more united than it's ever been. And really, we shouldn't worry about the fact that it's splitting apart. It's not a problem. But he said that in order to keep it together, they're going to send 10,000 more border guards to the borders to tackle unlawful immigration by 2020, he said. And he also suggested that there should be a new Africa-Europe alliance, based on cooperation rather than charity. Okay. Well, in order to give us an impression of what he meant by imposing the EU's position on others, we'll all be delighted to know that the EU passed the vote on the copyright legislation, the copyright directive today. That's the European Parliament. So MEPs have approved that, which means, you know, the two articles that everybody was particularly concerned about, Articles 11 and 13, are going to move towards becoming law, EU law, that is. So, of course, Article 11 is this so-called link tax that gives publishers and newspapers, it's being presented as a way to make money. But in fact, even if you don't want to make money, this directive, when it becomes law, will force you to make money because it's considered an unalienable right to charge anybody that wants to link to your material and use a snippet of your text to do so. And then Article 13, of course, is the article which requires the whole internet, it seems, to implement upload filters, so that if anybody's uploading content to the internet, it's automatically scanned for copyright material and automatically removed before it even gets up there. So Jean-Claude Juncker, was he sober? It's really hard to say, Brian.
Was he sober? It's hard to say. Maybe that's hard to say, but the danger of what you've just talked about is absolutely immense. And I'll just add that I spent a lot of yesterday having a look in depth at the PREVENT strategy, which is running across UK. My goodness, this is dangerous what's going on, but we'll come on to that in future news editions.
Let's move to Syria. Well, here's the delightful Karen Pierce, who was speaking at the United Nations Security Council yesterday. She, of course, is the UK's representative to the UN Security Council. And she said that, the horror of Syria has been unfolding before us for more than six slow years. After 9/11, Russia and Iran worked with us. We urge them to work with us now to halt the attacks and protect the civilians of Idlib. So we're going to accuse Russia of poisoning people on the streets of the UK, but we're going to work with them, she says she wants to deal with the situation in Idlib. She went on to say, we face a choice, Madam President, between an Assad Russian military assault on Idlib, which, as many colleagues have said today, thousands of civilians will die, or we allow Turkey and the opposition groups to support space and time to separate out the terrorists and tackle them themselves. So what exactly is she calling for here? She seems to be calling for effectively a civil war within what she describes as a civil war. And what effect would that have on civilians, do you think? Do you think perhaps many of them would be killed in such a situation?
Don't, They don't really care, Mike.
No.
They haven't cared about the civilians killed in Syria from the start of, well, it wasn't a war, it was an uprising sponsored by the UK and the US and Europe in particular. The problem now, I believe, is this fact that we've got American and British special forces trapped in the area, and they don't know what to do.
Well, I think that's right. But she went on to say the people of Idlib are going to suffer terribly if this military assault goes ahead. It's precisely for these situations that the doctrine of proportionality under international humanitarian law exists. So, you know, you can kill people as long as you do it proportionately. But anyway,
or you can put your troops inside a nation state. You have no authority to do it. You have no UN mandate. You put British troops on the ground in Syria, internationally unlawful. But then all of a sudden the situation changes and you've got to bring in...
Oh, you might have to move quickly. Now, hold that thought, because on Monday, Emily Thornberry, the shadow foreign secretary, made an intervention in the House of Commons. So let's have a listen to what she said.
And thank you for granting this urgent question. And let me congratulate my honourable friend, the member for Cardiff South and Penarth, for securing it. I can only echo what he has said regarding the terrible bloodshed and humanitarian crisis that is looming in Idlib and the urgency for all sides to be working for some form of peaceful political solution to avert it, and of course the importance of holding those responsible for war crimes to account. In the short time I have, Mr. Speaker, I want to press the government specifically on how it intends to respond if there are any reports over the coming weeks accompanied by horrifying Duma-style images suggesting the use of chemical weapons, particularly because of how the government responded after Duma, without seeking the approval of the House and without waiting for independent verification of those reports from the OPCW, and particularly because if this scenario does arise, it may do so over the next month when the House is in recess. We know from Bob Woodward's book that what Trump wants to do, what the President of the United States wants to do, is in the event of further reported chemical attack, is to commit to a strategy of regime change in Syria, and indeed had to be prevented from doing so after Duma. Now that would be a gravely serious step for the UK to take part in, with vast and very dangerous implications, not just for the future of Syria, but for wider geopolitical stability. And in the light of that, I hope the Minister of State will give us two assurances today. First, that if there are any reports of chemical weapon attack, particularly in the areas of Idlib controlled by HTS, that the government will not take part in any military action in response until the OPCW have visited those sites under the protection of the Turkish government, independently verifying those reports and attributed responsibility for any chemical weapons used. Relying on so-called open-source intelligence provided by proscribed terrorist groups is not an acceptable alternative. And second, Mr. Speaker, if the government does intend to take such action, thus escalating Britain's involvement in Syria and risking clashes with Russian and Iranian forces, will the Minister of State guarantee this House that we will be given a vote to approve such action before it takes place, even if that means recalling Parliament?
So she's made it quite clear what her position is on this. No intervention without parliamentary approval and no intervention without independent verification of any alleged chemical attack. Now, we've seen the reports in RT and other places that preparations by actors within Idlib for some kind of chemical attack are in place. So we wait to see what happens, but let's have a listen to what Alistair Burt's response to this was.
The coordinated action that was taken earlier this year with the United States and France was not about intervening in a civil war and was not about regime change. It was a discrete action to degrade and deter the use of chemical weapons by the Syrian regime in order to alleviate humanitarian suffering. Our position on the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons is unchanged. As we've demonstrated, we will respond appropriately to any further use of chemical weapons by the Syrian regime, which has had such devastating humanitarian consequences for the Syrian population. And if the Honourable Lady will recall, there are circumstances, depending on the nature of any attack, where the United Kingdom government needs to move swiftly, and it needs to move keeping in mind the safety of those personnel who would be involved in a mission as its utmost priority. I'm not prepared to say at this stage what the United Kingdom's detailed reaction might be or give any timescale, because the importance of responding appropriately, quickly and with the safety of personnel in mind will be uppermost in the minds of the United Kingdom.
So, in other words, get stuffed.
Well, he doesn't answer the question at all. It's completely evaded as to whether there's going to be discussion on it, whether there's going to be proper investigation to any stated alleged chemical weapons attack. So the government simply lies.
Well, indeed. But I mean, what he's saying there is we may have to act quickly and therefore we couldn't possibly, you know, we're reading between the lines.
Mike, even if you've got to act quickly, you can still draw people together for a debate in the House.
Absolutely.
But we, who is the we? We've now got a cabal running the country who make the decisions to put British troops on the ground in overseas nation states, not discussed in Westminster. We have a criminal cabal running the country.
Mm. Well, Peter Hitchens getting pretty wound up about all this. So this was in the Mail yesterday. Please write to your MP now. Without delay, war, terrible war, may be on the way again. Weapons of mass destruction all over again. Our government moves stealthily towards a new war of choice. And he says, is war coming? This is the traditional season of the year that for plunges into war by British governments which mislead themselves and the country about the extent and nature of what is proposed. In August 1914, we were ushered into war by a government secretly committed to an alliance with France and Tsarist Russia, which had never been discussed by Parliament or put to the Cabinet, let alone the public, who imagined that the August day that the war would chiefly be fought at sea and never imagined vast British armies dying in the mud of Flanders. He goes on to talk about World War II in 1939. And he ends by saying, I ask you to write swiftly and politely to your MP if any reputation, or sorry, of any reputation or party to say that you do not favour a rush to war, to say that the guilt of Syria has not been proved in the past, and that a rush to judgment on such issues is almost invariably unwise. See, for example, the lies told to Parliament about Suez, the use of the Gulf of Tonkin to obtain political support for the USA's Vietnam disaster, the non-existent weapons of mass destruction which began at the Iraq catastrophe, and the claims of non-existent massacres and mass rapes used to rush this country in its ill-judged and cataclysmic attack on Libya. Ask only for careful consideration for an insistence that no military action is taken by this country without Parliament's position after a full and calm debate. So he really not mentioning his words in a sense, because he's pulling out all the examples from the past where we've been duped, perhaps is the word, into war.
Yeah. And he's making a very good point that when people do come forward and challenge their MPs and enough people do it, they can bring sufficient pressure to bear that we get a different outcome. So a lot of this is down to what we do as the general public in this country. Do we just watch these government policies unfold, or do we actually take the right personal action to do something about it?
Well, as in 2013, really hacked off a few British parliamentarians, Brooks Newmark, for example. But in the meantime, as we mentioned on Monday, Exercise Trident Juncture is starting in a few weeks' time. This, of course, pretty close to Russia's sort of territory. But this is all about defence, all about defending NATO's nations, 40,000 people. Today, Russia, China have begun Vostok 2018. This is Russia's biggest war games since the fall of the Soviet Union. 300,000 troops involved in this, but it's taking place on the border with China. So China and Russia staging joint drills. You can see the type of activities that they're up to here. It is, as I say, the largest such drill that's taken place. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, this is serious. This is serious stuff, isn't it, by Russia? Relatively few Chinese military personnel involved, but nevertheless, the fact they are is hugely significant. But I think this is a statement by the Russians that they are not going to sit idly by if something is attempted in the Middle East. And the other thing they're doing, of course, is displaying the fact that largely the Russian military has been completely updated to an extent which has staggered the West. And one of the key statements that I'll come back to because of its importance is when you've got some US military, senior US military officers saying that the Russians' electronic warfare capability is eye-watering, that tells me that the Americans are completely on the back foot at the moment. And the same with the missile technology. So this is an alert for the Russian people, but it's also showing the rest of the world, I believe, that the Russians mean business. And I think they do in this case. They are not going to back down.
I absolutely agree. I was amused. I can't remember which it was. I think it was maybe Reuters suggested that this is also sending an unspoken reminder to Beijing that Moscow is able and ready to defend its sparsely populated Far East. Well, I mean, that's such a pile of nonsense. This is attempting to put Western thinking onto what's going on in Moscow and in Beijing, and we're going to come on to that a little bit later. But in the meantime, Israel has now eased its gun laws, apparently. So this follows on from the citizenship laws that it's put through recently, the so-called apartheid laws that people are talking about. So what they're saying is that this began in August. Israel's public security minister announced that more than 500,000 Israeli citizens would be able to own guns without the need for training or special permits. This is 500,000 extra. So it's estimated that 200,000 more settlers will now be able to carry arms. So these new laws allow, according to Al Jazeera here, any veteran of the IDF infantry to obtain gun permits as well as police officers. And the point they're making is that since conscription in Israel is mandatory at the age of 18, this basically permits everybody to carry weaponry all the time. And on top of that, any army personnel ranked lieutenant or higher is going to be allowed to keep their weapon when they leave the army, so they don't even have to buy their gun. So this is fantastic stuff. So following the nation state law, obviously lots of concern over this, because if you've, through the nation state law, created what's effectively a second class citizen, if even that, then really what danger are settlers in if they happen to shoot a Palestinian dead? Are they going to be prosecuted for it? It doesn't seem likely.
No, and I think we've got to add to that, Mike, that of course there are many groups inside Israel who are deeply unhappy with this policy coming from the Israeli government and are speaking out about it, but their views almost never brought out in Western, certainly British mainstream media.
But we'll end on a comedy note, I suppose, on this section, because UK warning to China, according to the Daily Star, Royal Navy boosts operations in the Far East over Beijing fears. So I wonder how many ships we're sending. Well, apparently it's one frigate. Brian is going to be based in Singapore for at least the next 4 years to counter Beijing's attempts to claim sovereignty in the South China Sea. So we're going to hold off the whole Chinese Navy with a frigate, which probably, I'm not sure what the water temperatures of Singapore are. I'm sure they're quite warm, but it probably isn't going to get too far, even if it heads out to sea.
Oh, this is true. I don't know what the survival time in hostilities would be, but I think it would be quite low. But we'll come on a little bit more to what's happening with UK military. First of all, let's have a look at The Guardian, and several people pointed this report out to us because it said it all, the observer view, the case against Putin is irrefutable, so charge him. And what did they want to do? Well, they were very keen on the European arrest warrant. This is what one of the paragraphs said. The notion of charging Putin himself raises the always controversial issue of immunity from prosecution that's normally afforded serving heads of state. Yet why wait until he's no longer president? European arrest warrants have been issued for the two principal suspects. Is it really so absurd to seek a warrant for their boss too? It would be a well-deserved humiliation, and there's no doubt Putin could help the police with their inquiries. How outrageous can you get? You recommend a European arrest warrant, and let's remember, of course, that all of the European dignitaries are above the law themselves. So you've got this hypocritical European Union organisation, and this wet paper, The Guardian Observer, wants to use that in order to put an arrest warrant out for Putin, charges based on evidence which doesn't exist. It's mind-blowing, really. I think that the mainstream media is floundering now. Like, they have lost the plot, and they know that people don't believe them. But let's dig in a bit deeper. We've got this. Thank you very much, the lady who pointed this out to us. It's Parliament UK. It's a House of Commons library briefing, the Salisbury incident. Encourage people to read it, because what it does is provides a simplistic, a child's narrative of the Salisbury incident. And I'll add, having made that comment, with no disrespect to children, but this is the standard of most of the parliamentary briefings. So we're told that our MPs are so busy they can't grasp all of the detail, even if it's a serious incident. What they have to have is a very simplistic, stylized briefing, which they grip in their hand, because that's become the evidence. And if we have a look at this article itself, and encourage people to go to that parliamentary website and have a look at it, this caught my eye, and I thought this was just excellent. It said in one paragraph, at least one commentator has said that some elements of this timeline, that's the Salisbury timeline, remain puzzling, although others have dismissed what they describe as conspiracy theories. Now, those were linked comments in blue. So we did just a little bit of work on that. If you click the first one, at least one comment, it takes you to Craig Murray's website, where he's asking a lot of very sensible questions about what's reporting. And I think in a very crude attempt to label him as a conspiracy theory, and no conspiracy theory gets mentioned in the paragraph, when you click on this second link, others have dismissed. What you've got is a chemist, a PhD chemist, and he gets into an argument with Craig Murray, really about whether the Novichok is Russian or not. And because he's a PhD chemist, he waxes lyrical on all matters to do with chemistry. And in this little spat, he says, so now you're going to lecture me on chemistry. This ought to be interesting. Let me give you some background to all this. When I heard who the victim was and that it was a nerve agent, I immediately suspected what the chemical formula was likely to be. And then there's a whole exchange about the chemical formulae used. So the first point here is that basically we've got the government researchers so desperate they're having to put this sort of stuff in order to brief MPs. I think this is very significant. But the spat they use amuses me. Others have dismissed what they describe as conspiracy theories. Because if you dig deeper into this man's tweets, back in March, he says this. No, it can't be proven beyond doubt, purely on chemistry, but the balance of probabilities is heavily skewed towards Russia. And until I hear a more convincing alternative explanation, I'm sticking to my guns. So the chemist starts off by saying, well, the chemistry says this and that. And then he admits that you can't actually prove it simply by the chemistry. But the government, of course, doesn't read all of the tweets. So the government doesn't even pick up what they're talking about anyway. So encourage people to go and have a look at that. And then the good news is that when you look across social media in a wider sense, you can find other people really pulling this stuff apart. We've got Charles Shoebridge here. Scripple case against Putin is irrefutable, says Guardian on Sunday. The sources for the brackets, unverified factual claims, the article cites. Two sensational UK tabloids, the irrefutable evidence, nothing other than the unevidenced claims of Theresa May. And I think this is really excellent, because we're getting people now not just taking the mainstream nonsense and keeping quiet. They're getting active on social media and making their comment. And as the parliamentary briefing document has shown us, even the government now is having to pick up on what people are saying about their own reports. But let's get into details. If Putin is a problem, I don't think UK is going to be doing much about it, because we've now got real details coming out about the state of the armed forces. We have been saying this for month after month, in fact, year after year, that Britain's armed forces being utterly betrayed, and this is to a planned policy. Well, now we can sort of show some of the detail of that. So we've got Parliament Common Select Committee, and the headline is Mod needs to plug skills gaps and face emerging threats. And this is really quite amazing stuff here. It says in January 2018, the armed forces had the largest shortfall of regulars for many years. It has skill shortages in over 100 critical trades. There's a long-standing problem, and the Ministry of Defence does not expect to close the shortfall of 8,200 regulars until 2022. And on it goes. But down at the bottom, MOD has not developed a coherent plan for closing the existing skill gaps. It currently has skill shortages in critical trades, including a 23% shortfall in pilot trades. I wonder whether that includes the F-35, Mike. Well, we don't know. 26% shortfall in intelligent analyst trades and 17% shortfall in engineers. And what we have consistently reported is the Royal Navy at the moment is virtually incapable of getting ships to sea. Same in the submarine fleet or surface fleet, because they haven't got the engineers to do it.
Let me ask you a question on this, Brian, because one of the things that we know is that if we look at some of the new warships that are not sailing around the place at the moment because the engines don't work.
Type 45.
For example. Royal Naval engineers are not allowed to work on those engines. That has to be BAE engineers, right?
Yes.
So are they not developing a coherent plan for closing the skills gaps, because this is going to be increasingly privatised?
Well, I think this is what we're about to demonstrate as we follow this article through.
Okay.
Mike, absolutely on the button. Let's have a look at this lady who commented. So it's Meg Hillier. She's the chair of the Public Accounts Committee that did this report. She said this: the government's make do and mend approach to staffing its defence commitments cannot continue. Muddling through is unsustainable. A point underlined by the fact that twice as many forces regulars describe morale as low than did at the start of the decade. So we can see everything is falling apart, and she's saying that quite accurately. She goes on, the MOD must ensure the armed forces have skilled personnel they need to tackle established and emerging threats to national security. A creative, effective workforce strategy is long overdue, but it will be vital if the stresses of today are not to become the crises of tomorrow. A creative, effective workforce strategy. What do you think that might be? Well, before we get on to the detail of that, we just add that to make sure the morale of the armed forces continues to drop, there seems to be some shenanigans going on with pay at the moment. So this is an early day motion that's been put in saying, well, if we're going to adhere to the armed forces pay review body, we need to get on and do it. So I smell a rat over this one, but nevertheless, there's some form of delay to the armed forces pay increase. But let's have a look at who's doing the recruiting. And we're back on our old friend's Capita. And this is where it just gets astonishing, because if we have a look at what Capita says, Capita's entrusted by the UK Ministry of Defence to deliver a range of core business services of national importance. The responsibilities implicit in these undertakings taken extremely seriously. And then we get into really remarkable stuff. We understand that in future, the first choice for UK defence manpower capabilities will be the whole force approach, WFA. WFA is a flexible workforce construct for defence that will enable the delivery of military outputs in the most efficient and effective way, blending military, civil service, regular reserves, sponsored reserves, and contractors.
Fusion doctrine.
This is fusion. So we're taking the armed forces out of the control and oversight of a democratic government, and we're going to mix it into the private sector in a fusion. That is the correct description, a fusion. This is groundwork for the unified EU military structure, and we're now really starting to see what it is. So Capita got the contract. Ever since Capita's had the contract, we've got problems recruiting, but we're going to solve those recruiting problems by bringing in, well, private contractors. Well, let's have a look at the people running this Capita business. We'll have to do this very quickly, eye on the clock at the moment. But let's have a look. We've got Sir Ian Powell, non-executive chairman. And what's his background? Price Waterhouse accountant. We've got Jonathan Lewis, the chief executive officer. AMAC Foster Wheeler and Halliburton. So this is big international construction and military industrial complex type person. We've got Nick Greatorex. He's another accountant, Liberata PLC. That's a sort of government advisory consultancy. We've got this lovely lady here, Gillian Sheldon. Well, she's a banker. Credit Suisse and MN Rothschild. These are the people now controlling policy within the armed forces. And on it goes, John Cresswell, another accountant with a background in media, ITV and Aquiva. We've got Matthew Lester, accountant, Royal Mail, but also Kleinwort Benson. And he's a non-exec director for Barclays, another banker, effectively. We've got Baroness Lucy Neville. Well, she comes straight out of politics to help advise this company. Obviously, she's in the House of Lords. She's got a background in the Treasury, Energy and Culture departments. But her main professional expertise is Tesco, ideal for all matters military, as you can understand, Mike. And the final man, Andrew Williams here. Well, he's got some engineering experience, but he's a health and safety man in particular. So this is the company of one, which has now got their teeth into Britain's military. The military being pulled apart so we can come up with the excuse that the only way we can save it is to bring in more firms and contractors like Capita. Mm. And is it any wonder, Monday we showed this article where members of the ship's company of Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier had gone ashore in America and had a punch up, not with Americans, but amongst themselves. That, to me, was a clear indicator of rock bottom morale on the ship. They can't wait to get ashore and beat hell out of each other. And this is the state of the military, which apparently is going to be taking on Russia. People have commented on it. So this is going back to June 2018. Where some MPs were calling on Capita to be stripped of the defence contract. But of course, nothing has actually happened. This is one of the key statements. The repeated failures of Capita have affected recruitment across all three services and have done particularly serious damage to army recruitment. If the service provided does not significantly improve very soon, the department should implement its contingency plans and take recruitment back into its own hands. Well, the government isn't going to do that because, of course, they want the breakdown in order to start privatising the military. And I'll just throw this in as a link to the Middle East. We'd got a grant of about 5 million was going to be given to moderate terrorists. This is in
Jordan.
Jordan, thank you, Mike. This is in Jordan. Because the situation has got a little bit squidgy in Syria, they're going to donate this non-lethal equipment to the Jordanian armed forces. So no money for UK armed forces. But we had the odd 5 million that we were going to give to moderate terrorists, but we've now decided maybe it's a bit hot to handle, so we're going to give it to the Jordanian armed forces. You could not make this stuff up, Mike.
No. Well, while Vostok 2018 is going on with Russia and Chinese military personnel, the Eastern Economic Forum is also taking place, began yesterday in Vladivostok in Russia. And 6,000 political and business leaders from 60 countries attending the fourth annual Eastern Economic Forum which is organized by President Putin. So there's the floor of the room. It's the whole point of this is to try to develop Russia's Far East. It's only a week ago that the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, hosted by President Xi in China, took place. So this is following on from that, and many of the African leaders that were at that are also at this. So this is all about economic development and not about blowing the planet up. This is the first time President Xi has attended as President of China. What were they saying? Well, they were, Putin was saying our relations are critical. This is the relations between Russia and China, not only for our countries, but for the world as well. President Xi said it allows us to jointly neutralize the external risks and challenges and to assist joint development. Putin went on to say that he was pretty pleased that 1,000 Chinese were in attendance of this. This is understandable, he said, because of the volume of our relations is very large. And he said that after he had met Xi on the sidelines of the conference, he said, we'll continue with our joint efforts on the political and diplomatic settlement of the situation in North Korea, in the Korean Peninsula, in line with the Russian-Chinese roadmap. We support steps taken by the authorities of China and North Korea on the restoration of bilateral relations and hope for the efficiency, of another inter-Korean summit in Pyongyang. I think there's a bit of translation going on here. We firmly believe that an important element in the overall settlement of the situation on the Korean Peninsula is the normalization of relations between the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and the United States. And then they went on to say there are several dozens of cooperating pairs of Russian and Chinese regions. We place great importance on this, and Chairman Xi Jinping spoke about it directly at today's meeting. So that's what's going on there. But Putin and President Abe, the Japanese Prime Minister, discussing normalizing relations between Russia and Japan by the end of the year. Now, Abe had asked before this meeting started that there was some agreement from Putin that there should be discussions about this, because of course there's never been a cessation of the war. The Second World War has never actually been formally closed between Russia and Japan. Putin said here during this meeting, an idea has come into my head. Let's conclude a peace treaty before the end of the year without any preconditions. And then on the basis of this peace treaty, as friends, we will continue to resolve all controversial issues. It seems to me that this would facilitate the solution of all our problems with which we've not dealt for over 70 years. So that's what's going on over there. While the West is trying to blow up the planet, people in the East seem to be trying to do something slightly different.
Absolutely, Mike. And I'll just add, there's some amazing history which many people have not seen much about, because Western media simply doesn't want to tell the story. But of course, at the end of the Second World War, the Russians moved millions of troops out of Western Europe, transferred them all the way across Russia to the east in order to help the Chinese remove the remains of the Japanese army out of China. None of that ever reported in any great detail, but if you're interested in the subject because you haven't read much about it before, there's some very, very good YouTube documentaries on that now. So a lot of politics there in the east, Mike, which the West has simply ignored as if it doesn't exist.
Good news, Brian, because we've had confirmation today of more carnage. Mark Carney will stay as the governor of the Bank of England until the 31st of January 2020. So that's fantastic stuff. And this, of course, taking place as more and more people now warning an economic collapse, possibly worse than what happened in 2007-2008. It, of course, is going to be worse than that, because none of the issues led up to that collapse in 2007 have been addressed. In fact, the situation has got much worse since then. And what's interesting is that, of course, Mark Carney has been confirmed as the governor for an extended period of time. The Bank of England's stress tests on the banks and whether the banks could survive further economic, further financial system problems, is all based on their capital reserves. And so the stress test based on their capital reserves. I was just interested that the BBC this morning was pushing out a little audio clip from the chief executive of Lehman Brothers, because it's 10 years since Lehman Brothers collapsed. And he was making the point following the collapse of Lehman Brothers that actually Lehman Brothers had a very good capital reserve situation. It wasn't a capital reserves problem that Lehman Brothers had. It was a liquidity problem, and that what they needed was a short-term solution to deal with the liquidity problem. Now, you could argue about that, but the point here is that Mark Carney's sort of stress test, Mark Carney's ability to decide whether banks are capable of surviving a further economic crisis or financial system crisis, rather, based on the very measurement that didn't apply in Lehman Brothers' case, I think we're in pretty serious trouble when this hits.
This one hits.
Yeah.
Well, we'll end on a lighter or not so lighter note. A number of people pointed this article out to me, which has got some interest factor. This young lady, Carrie Symons, is the young lady that Boris Johnson has been linked to, is the expression that you have to use now. He's been linked to her. So the Mail has obviously done quite a bit of digging, pointed out that she's full of glamorous poses. But what was interesting was that they're also pointing out that, albeit in her younger days, she was performing in a satanic, pretty unpleasant play. This is university times. So they had some images of that. So here is a shot for the particular thing. She's starring as the young lady in the torn tights and interesting eye makeup, but of course the setting is absolutely a ritualistic setting. And the Mail did go to the trouble of blowing up the image, putting an inset image so that you could see what was actually written on the table: cognac, a four-letter swear word, and cocaine, and pointed out that actually this came straight from Crowley's poem Le Sublime. I won't read it out. People can freeze the screen to have a look at it. But it just showed that this young lady seems to have some very interesting background. I noticed that a number of commentators are saying, well, the fact that Boris Johnson is getting rid of his second wife and possibly moving on to a new young lady, this shouldn't preclude him from being prime minister. And of course, that's absolutely right, because moral values now simply don't count in your political career. But I'll leave people to think as to if there's any significance in that report at all. I found it of interesting. I found it of interest. And that's partly because of the fact that we know that ritualistic abuse of children is on the rise, but we still have mainstream journalists and reporters trying to deny that that is the case. And this one we've actually mentioned before, but quite a long time ago. But the Mail, particularly good article about the use of AI to transfer facial expressions between images and videos, to the extent that one person saying something could be made to look as though somebody completely different had actually said those words. And in the article, the Mail says that researchers acknowledge that face-swapping AIs hold potentially disastrous consequences if used in the wrong hands. The inference, of course, is that sort of criminals are going to get hold of this stuff. But I'm going to say to people, I think the real danger is in this technology becoming available to our own government and its agents, so that, for example, it would be much easier to spin the story about Salisbury. We could actually have those two suspects, in inverted commas, caught on video saying X, Y, and Z. They've never said it, but the video has been manhandled by British deep state.
Oh, we could have them walking around a house in Salisbury if they'd never been there.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. Okay, well, we'll end there. Serious times. But perhaps we should follow the advice of the Daily Mail there. If you're worried about what's happening in the Middle East, then pick up the phone, email, tweet, write letters, and start to put some real pressure on your local MPs that Britain should not be getting into a war in the Middle East. Peter Hitchens, brave enough to stand up and say that. I think he deserves some support. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back on Friday.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.